From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Senator Debbie Stabenow talks about who gets the child tax credit expansion and who might want to pass.
If you're someone who got the $1,400 stimulus check or you're filing taxes every year, you're going to automatically see this begin to happen.
We'll also discuss the pile of federal money headed to Michigan cities to make infrastructure fixes. Plus, the legacy of Native boarding schools in Michigan.
The hardest part of the colonization, or the most direct, is when you start to target kids.
And we'll hear how music educators took on virtual learning.
It's intriguing to me to think about the ways that people turn to the arts as a way to center themselves in their humanity during the early days of the pandemic.
Also, what those teachers will have to do to reboot music education in the fall. Those stories coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Michigan's dark history of boarding schools for Native children.
The hardest part of the colonization, or the most direct, is when you start to target kids.
After devastating revelations of mass graves at Canadian school sites, a wider conversation has kicked off about a shattering chapter in state history. That conversation's coming up later in the show. First, Democrats holding the narrow margin in the U.S. Senate have spent the first half of the year passing a number of agenda items. They're limited in number, but arguably very significant in terms of America's recovery from the pandemic and future path. Debbie Stabenow joins us now. She is chairwoman of the Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry. And she joins us now. We're going to talk about recovery and more. Senator Stabenow, welcome.
Always great to be with you.
You know, folks may have been kind of buried in their own affairs this year, and those with kids may be surprised to find a bump in their checking accounts or a check in the mailbox later this month. This is, of course, the expanded child tax credit that Congress passed. Can you tell us about what was the thinking behind doing this?
Well, this is really good news, and it's something I've been working to do now for a long time, so it's wonderful to have President Biden and frankly, it was Democrats who voted for this to be able to pass it. And we are in a situation now where the child tax credit that's normally available to families when they file their taxes in the spring is going to be, first of all, larger and extend children up to age 17. And it's now going to be available on a monthly benefit. So it's a tax cut for working families that will come the way families need it, which is on a monthly basis. And the other piece is that families who are earning less than the poverty level, who didn't get the child tax credit in the past and frankly need it the most, are now going to be able to do it. So if you're working, but your minimum wage job and you're below the poverty line and you don't have to file income taxes, you're still going to be able to get this important child tax credit. The thing I would really emphasize, though, is that if you're someone who got the $1,400 stimulus check or you're filing taxes every year, you're going to automatically see this begin to happen. And you should have already received some kind of a notice. But if you didn't get a notice or you didn't get the $1,400 stimulus check, that means you need to go to childtaxcredit.gov, G-O-V, and sign up to make sure that you get it.
You know, it's been suggested that some families might actually want to consider opting out depending on their income level. Is that something you could provide some clarity on? I mean, is it possible that if folks are not attentive to what benefits they have received, that they might want to look at their options in terms of maybe opting out of the credit?
It's absolutely a family's choice. So again, you can go to childtaxcredit.gov. If for some reason you would prefer the value of the tax credit when you do your taxes, you certainly have the choice to do that. I should mention that the full credit is available for couples with children up to $150,000 in income. And a single head of household, that's about $112,000. So you're welcome to decide to opt out. You can let the IRS know that and continue with the current way that you receive this tax cut. But if you want to be able to get this kind of assistance on a monthly basis, this is something that will now be available for the first time.
Senator, we haven't had a chance to catch up on agricultural issues since you came into your leadership position this term within your committee assignments. And I wanted to ask you, I know for a lot of years now you've been hoping to get a national carbon credit trading market opened. Can you update us on what's going on in agriculture for that and if you think that's going to happen within the next year and a half?
Well, this is also some very good news, and it's taken a long time. I actually started working on this about 10 years ago, trying to work with our farmers and foresters about the climate crisis. And, of course, for an awful long time, folks have not been admitting that it was happening, or, you know, there's a lot of misinformation that's been out there, a whole campaign by those who are the coal producers and oil producers. They want us to continue using fossil fuels. So they told everybody that this was a mess. And we now see very clearly with the weather happening all the time, the extreme highs, extreme lows. We're seeing the Great Lakes warm faster than the oceans. I mean, everywhere we look, there are ramifications of this. And so I'm really pleased that our farmers and ranchers and those who are forest landowners are now stepping up and saying, you know, as the original stewards of the land, we want to do more. We know this is real. What can be done? And so the next step is to work with them on more aggressive, active conservation efforts. They're already doing conservation, land, water conservation, and then help them measure the savings, whether it's carbon or methane capture or nitrogen oxide, help them measure the amount of greenhouse gases that they are keeping out of the atmosphere, and then help them be able to turn that into credits that they then could sell on a carbon exchange. And that would be really a win-win to be able to create essentially carbon as a commodity and create a value for farmers and foresters who are doing the right thing. And we know that with the efforts that we've passed a bill of mine called Growing Climate Solutions Act that passed overwhelmingly. We had 55 co-sponsors in the Senate, which is unheard of, about half Democrats, half Republicans. 92 out of 100 people voted for it a couple of weeks ago in the Senate. And it really is the first time there's been broad bipartisan acknowledgement of the climate crisis and supporting a sector of our economy to really step up and lead.
So this may surprise people who don't follow ag news very much to know that farm communities and agribusinesses have gotten on board with this. They're very interested. But you don't have to tell anybody in farm country about the effects of extreme weather and climate, given what's been happening with drought and flood all across the region. And this is true nationally as well. But I just want to know, I mean, I feel like I'm seeing some conflicting stories about the science behind, you know, paying farmers to plant crops that absorb carbon dioxide. How can we be sure that this is going to have a measurable effect with respect to our carbon emissions right now?
Well, that's the whole point of my legislation, is that the USDA is putting together the science, the measurement, the experts. And rather than having what's happening right now is like the wild, wild west. One of the farmers said to me, somebody will come out and say, I've got a great deal for you. And, you know, if you do this, that, and the other, you'll be able to create carbon credits. And it turns out it really doesn't. And, you know, they've put out funding and effort. And a lot of times, you know, basically it's a Wall Street type model. And what we're saying is, no, this is going to be something that is built around farmers and foresters. And in order to be able to measure and be able to get the carbon credit possibility, you have to go through rigorous standards. It has to be measurable. It has to be beyond what they're doing now. And then it's just a matter of they're having the opportunity of basically receiving a USDA, you know, stamp of sustainability. And then they have to go into the private markets and actually decide whether or not there's value, whether or not they will be paid for the credits. Right now, there's no system based on science that's measurable and has integrity behind it. And so therefore, the private markets don't even really work for agriculture because there's no integrity in the process and confidence that this is actually being measured correctly.
Michael Regan, the administrator of the EPA, is in Detroit today talking to folks in the region about what President Biden has in mind for infrastructure changes and the massive infusion of cash that the federal government is going to make available to our cities, our counties, and our state. This is, again, very timely given what just happened with flooding and what has happened over time as Michigan's infrastructure has aged. But I did want to ask, there are so many really pressing needs in our cities and towns, urgent infrastructure and operational needs. And this money's been described as transformative. Do you think that the funding can be used for transformative projects when we've got 4 alarm fires going on with our water and road systems all over Michigan?
Well, I think we have to do both. First of all, we have to deal with the basic lack of investment in infrastructure for a long time. One of the things is completely eliminating all the lead pipes in Michigan across the country, which is essential, as well as dealing with roads and bridges and all of the other basic infrastructure. And then we've got to add to that what needs to happen around what we now call resiliency, or being able to handle all of these floods and storms and so on, and the additional cost that we're going to have just to be able to, in the short run, handle these things so it's not shutting down, you know, southeast Michigan or any part of Michigan because of what's happening on the roadways and the flooding and so on. And then, on top of that, we have to deal with the other piece, which is to stop the pollution that's going into the atmosphere that's causing all this. We have 100 years of pollution, putting carbon and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. It's held there. It doesn't go away. It's held there. And now we're seeing the cumulative effect everywhere we look. So we have to address the bigger issues at the same time we're addressing what's right in front of us to be able to keep families and communities safe.
Senator Debbie Stabenow speaking to us from the road on I-96. Senator, thank you so much.
Always good to talk to you. Take care.
In a moment, what arts educators have to do to reboot music education this fall.
It is, I think, much harder to not have that magic and that joy of actually connecting in person.
That story after a short break. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Over the past year, arts educators have had to get extremely creative in order to accommodate public health guidelines. And that burden has fallen pretty heavily on teachers of performing arts. The challenge has been even greater for teachers who may not have the space or resources to get creative in their classrooms. And this is something that everyone's been mindful of as we think about a return to school next fall. As public health restrictions are lifted, educators are working hard to prepare. Dr. Kate Fitzpatrick Harnish is an associate professor of music education at the University of Michigan. And we wanted to turn to her to think this through a little bit. Kate, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Do you think teachers lose something when they are not in practice with their music students every day?
Yeah, I think there's nothing more than our teachers want than to be with their kids, with their students. There is something magical that happens, particularly in an arts classroom, when people come together. You know, I'm thinking about like a general music classroom for first graders, you know, and you have kids walk in and you're singing, but you're also dancing and moving and creating and shaking shakers and doing all sorts of those things. And some of that is obviously much trickier on technology. I feel for our music teachers. You know, when I was a practicing teacher in the schools, I never had to face that type of a circumstance and challenge. So there certainly are tremendous challenges that our teachers face in not doing that. And I think especially trying to carry themselves forward through that experience. You know, all of them had their own families at home with them, just like everyone else too, and navigating all of that. So it is, I think, much harder to not have that magic and that joy of actually connecting in person.
Your work focuses on music education in urban schools. What happened in our urban districts this year with performing arts?
Yeah, you know, my work focuses on the experiences of historically marginalized populations in music education, and particularly within those larger urban districts where a lot of the lack of resources is especially noted. And what I look at are some issues of equity related to arts education, which seem to be especially profound in those larger districts. So one of the things that I've really tried to ask people during this pandemic, you know, if everybody listening is reflecting a little bit on their initial pandemic experience, I think all of us at one point or another probably turned to the arts as a way of coping with the pandemic and with what was happening. You know, if I think about, you know, things like art kits sold out really quickly in the pandemic, and people generally, I think, started, if they had an instrument in a closet, some people pulled them out, some people were singing and dancing and learning to knit and crochet. It's intriguing to me to think about the ways that people turn to the arts as a way to center themselves in their humanity during the early days of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And when I talk with people about those experiences, you know, what do the arts mean to you in your life? What generally emerges in those conversations is that the arts are a way to be human. They're a way to feel, they're a way to create, they're a way to be. And it's something that is a universal value to almost all of us. And I think that in the pandemic, that was especially felt and perceived by all of us. Where my concern goes with arts equity is that the universality of that human experience and that human connection to the arts is not translated into the support that we provide for the arts within schools, especially according to the zip code a child grows up in. So if we as human beings, you know, experience the arts as a part of who we are, and sure, there can be conversations about, you know, the arts and connections to cognitive development and all sorts of other things. There are a lot of wonderful studies out there people can look at. But why does every human being deserve access to the arts? In my mind, that's because of that way that the arts encourage us to be human and to grow closer to our humanity. So I grow very concerned when I see that in our really well-resourced school districts and schools, the arts are very supported, not only enthusiastically by people in those schools, but also through funding dollars and through making sure that students have a robust experience and sequential experience in the arts. Mm-hmm. And in many of our other schools, that's not the case. And I think we saw more of that emerge through the pandemic. Our under-resourced students who lacked access to certain technologies and other things, you know, the arts are sometimes the first thing to go. But if I look forward and I think about what lessons I hope we learned about the arts, arts education, and especially arts equity, I really hope that this is going to propel us to make changes that are meaningful in this space. So if we need to actually nurture our humanity, if that's something that we as a society have perhaps realized is even more important through this experience of the pandemic together, if we believe that's important for all of our children to make sure that they have experiences within their schools, our democratic schools are places where our collective values as a society are equitably enacted. And so I do hope that we seize this moment, seize this opportunity post-pandemic to recognize that we need to fully support the arts in schools for all children, regardless of the zip code that they grew up in.
What do you see music educators struggling with as pre-pandemic life starts to grind back into action?
Yeah, I think this transition back, of course, there's this initial, I think, just welcoming of the opportunity to be back in person. I'm back in person at the University of Michigan with my students this week, with some of my graduate students. And again, I think there's just such a beautiful connection that's happening. And we've all been so starved for these opportunities that it's wonderful. But I think there are some other things that we're going to be navigating in arts education and music education moving forward. Again, how do we decide to use technology in the future here? We've learned that there are some things it's not great at helping us with as we engage with students in the arts, but we've learned there are some other ways that it is. Perhaps some ways that using technology can even help us address equity with students who may not have access to certain resources in certain areas. The other part is that I do think having to pivot and learn new ways of doing things through the pandemic has caused arts educators to be very creative in what types of experiences they're providing our students. There are some long-lasting conversations in the arts about whether the arts should be primarily performance-based in schools or whether other creative ways of knowing and understanding the arts perhaps should have more of a place in the curriculum.
Right.
So we have seen a lot of teachers pivot to addressing creative activities within music and the other arts, such as improvisation and composition, that were easier to do on Zoom, or not even easier, but that teachers really work to learn more about. So I think moving forward, arts and music teachers will be probably navigating that for the betterment of their classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that we are trying to figure out as well that music and the arts are not activities in schools that are separated from the whole child and the whole student. And I think through the pandemic, teachers have had a window into their child's home life. And music and the arts are something that everyone experiences within their own world, within their own lives. And I think we're working too, and we'll have to have continuing conversations. How can we connect more with music and the arts that the student already engages in within their own cultural communities, their churches, their places of worship, their communities as a whole? That I think offers some really wonderful opportunities for richness as we move forward. And I also just hope that, you know, moving forward, teachers have certainly been through a lot this year, as have we all. But I think in the beginning of the pandemic, we really appreciated teachers probably more than they've felt lately in our society. I think many of us who have children like I do have noticed our teachers really work miracles with each and every one of our students. And we've probably lost a little of that sense of appreciation as this year has gone on. So I do hope that moving forward, one of the big changes we will have as well is that our society will collectively give teachers their due and work to make sure that they feel appreciated for all of the amazing things that they're doing.
Kate Fitzpatrick Harnish is the author of Urban Music Education, A Practical Guide for Teachers. She's an associate professor of music ed at U of M. Kate, it's a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
The U.S. Department of Interior has announced a new investigation into residential boarding schools across the United States. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, who is Laguna Pueblo, says that her department, having operated boarding schools for so long, is, quote, uniquely positioned to assist in the effort to recover the dark history of these institutions that have haunted our families for too long. All this follows recent and dreadful revelations on the other side of the Great Lakes. Two mass graves of children at residential boarding schools at opposite ends of Canada. Michigan's history is not exempt from this story. With us today to talk more is Natan Kyogima, Anishinaabe Mohwin language specialist at the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. And Eric Hemingway is with us too. He's director of archives and records for the Little Traverse Bay Bands. Eric, Natan, it's nice to have you. Welcome to Stateside.
Buju ani, minobimoseko indishnakaz, mikizen dodam, waganaksing odawa indodipendagwas. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
So there were no less than three federal boarding schools in Michigan that were part of a much broader effort across the U.S. and Canada to quash Indigenous culture and assimilate Indigenous people into white culture. Eric, can you tell us a little bit about where the boarding school system came from?
The boarding schools started out as part of a larger mission by the federal government to assimilate and quote unquote civilize Native people. And it's part of this larger idea that Natives were quote unquote savages, heathens, uncivilized. And a lot of the schools started out as what we call mission schools. And these schools were actually joint operations between local tribal communities and the local denomination that was there, whether it's Catholic or Protestant. But it's very important to note that many of these schools were cooperatives between the Native families who chose to send their kids to these schools and be Christian with that denomination. They weren't forced to do this. And a lot of these schools would later transition into government boarding schools. Like Holy Childhood started out as a mission school in the 1820s, but then it became a formal government boarding school in the 1880s.
Yeah. Where were these schools? And do we know anything about who was sent there?
Well, there was hundreds of schools across the country. And we had three government operated schools here in Michigan, one up in Berrega, one here in Harbor Springs, the Holy Childhood, and then one down in Mount Pleasant, the industrial school. And Native kids would come from different areas to these schools. So, for example, at Holy Childhood, it was very common to have Ojibwes from the western end of the UP in Wisconsin. And it was very common for our kids to go to other schools such as Mount Pleasant. But then we had kids go to Genoa, Kansas, Carlisle, Pennsylvania. So there was a lot of rearranging of people. And this also, in my mind, follows in this idea of removal that was prevalent in the 1830s and 40s. Removal was still going on in the late 1800s and early 1900s of kids.
Yeah. Natan, what did you hear about or what did you know of these schools growing up? Did you have much access to the history of boarding schools in Michigan?
I would say not until I was a teenager. I had a lot of history with like protest and activism with my parents being in AIM with the American Indian Movement. So I always, you know, knew I was Native. I always was proud to be Native. It was hard, but I didn't come into language revitalization and knowledge of language until I was a teenager and kind of going on my own journey of, you know, as just trying to figure out who I was. And that's kind of when I came into hearing and learning about what happened to our, you know, ancestors, what happened to our people. And I started to become more aware, more interested of how Native languages were, you know, still in danger.
Right. Eric, what about you? Did you have any family members who had stories to tell about boarding schools or just older folks you might have talked to?
My story is much like Natan's. I didn't start to realize or know about the boarding school until I was a little bit older. And my mom, like Natan's mom, was into activism and protest. So I would be taken to these certain events, whether it was, you know, we protested the Big Rock nuclear plant when that was going on, and there was anti-Native fishing protests that we would go and protest against in Charlevoix. But during all of this, it was brought up that, you know, this institution was in our backyard called the boarding school, and that it wasn't the best place for Native, especially kids. So that was my first introduction to the school. And then as I got into my career as a researcher, I was really drawn towards this, what this institution was. And then it became this larger picture of not just Harbor Springs or the Odawa, but Native people across North America and the world, that this idea of colonizing Native people is widespread. And the hardest part of the colonization, or the most direct, is when you start to target kids.
It was impossible not to feel a sense of shock about what happened at the Merrival and Kamloops sites. And given how recent the history is in Michigan's tribal communities, what kinds of conversations have you been hearing amongst friends about what happened in these discoveries?
When this started coming about, it is shocking to hear it, but I already knew about mass graves. Like those have already been talked about within Native communities, families, and any kind of Native institution. And this was kind of the first one that came up, like on social media. Like we already knew just by sharing with each other and talking with each other, you know, we know that there's mass graves at certain boarding schools here in the U.S. and in Canada. My first time even going to one was the school in Canada, boarding school. I believe it's in Spanish. And I was actually in a language institute. And during this institute, the teachers there, who are fluent speakers now, but they were sent to these boarding schools to, you know, to colonize them, to assimilate them. And they actually, there are some students that kept their language. And a lot of those students are language teachers now. In my case, our two teachers were residential boarding school survivors. And so we went to the school and they told us, you know, these horrific stories, and you could see the pain in their eyes while they were looking at the school. It was like the school, of course, was just like it just looked like a just remnants. It was like a skeleton of this building, and we're looking at it and watching them looking at it was very striking, because you could see and feel the pain, and they were telling us the stories about what would happen, what they saw, what they witnessed. And then there was a lake there that they were talking about. They knew students, children their age, who tried to swim across this lake, and they would drown. And so even going to the lake and knowing that Native children drowned in this lake because they were trying to escape and trying to go back home, I mean, it was just like it's like a reality. You're just like stricken, like, oh my gosh, like this happened, you know, and we're here, and we're in this language institute now, this school that's trying to bring our language back. And so it was something very painful and kind of beautiful at the same time, because here I am, because of your sacrifice, I'm able to stand here and learn my language from the survivors. So Native people knew that this has been going on, but it was never mainstream like it is now.
In just a moment, we're going to continue our conversation with Natan Kiogema and Eric Hemingway about how Michigan tribes are working to reclaim what was taken by federally run boarding schools. Stay with us. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. Let's get back now to our conversation about the legacy of Michigan's boarding schools for Native children and how tribes are reclaiming what was lost during the era of assimilation. We're talking today with Natan Kiogema, Anishinaabe Mohwin language specialist for the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. And Eric Hemingway joins us, too. He's director of archives and records for the Little Traverse Bay Bands. Eric, in terms of the historical record, what kind of documents and stories do we have of people's times at Michigan's residential schools?
Well, the records are widespread, and I always want to include the oral histories of the survivors as a primary source. That just because it's not written down doesn't mean it's, you know, not as valid as other sources. And so with the written record, it's really spread out, and it's been really difficult, you know, collecting some of these records. The rectory for the Holy Childhood Church burned in the 1970s out in Cross Village. So a large number of records literally went up in smoke. And we've been seeing a lot of records on, of all places, eBay. Like, people have these private collections of Holy Childhood materials. I'm not quite sure where they got them from, but they're coming up for sale. So it's just everywhere you can think of. And we collect all that we can. And a lot of this is just very like stats of, you know, how many kids were in the school. Sometimes we have names, rosters, postcards, photos, letters. So we're trying to piece together the story as much as we can. But then also being mindful that when putting the story together, there's a lot of trauma involved. There's a lot of pain that goes into the story, and approaching this with that sensitivity, because I personally didn't go to the boarding school. I went to a one-room schoolhouse on Cross Village, and then went to Harbor Springs. But you know, I've known people that have gone there. They've had very traumatic experiences. And some people didn't have traumatic experiences. So it's a very complicated story, but the story remains that it was a place where a lot of kids experienced this abuse. And so having that story come out, or having the ability to tell that story, has been really touchy. And I, you know, some people come forward and tell the story, but they don't, you know, have it recorded, or they don't write it down. And so it's passed on orally, which is our tradition. So it's been a tough go to get this information. But then at the same time, you know, how to manage that information once you obtain it, because we have so many survivors that are still with us to this day. And this is the anomaly that's Holy Childhood, that it went on in operation for decades after the majority of other schools closed. So it officially closed in 1983, and the largest boarding school in the country at Carlisle closed in 1924. So that kind of tells you the story of Holy Childhood. So we have a lot of people who went there in the 60s and 70s, and they did not have good experiences. And a lot of kids didn't make it out of Holy Childhood. You know, they are buried around that school. So it's a very, very sensitive piece of our history, piece of our story. So it's one thing to collect it, but then how do you tell the story?
Natan, I've got to believe that the history of boarding schools is really integral to the work that you do in helping people reserve and use their language. How do you see the legacy of those schools impacting the tribal community today?
It is such a motivation with our department and our staff. I've been here for 8 years now, and I would say almost every couple of years, every few years, we've lost the last of our fluent speakers here. They all went to boarding schools, and some of the stories that I remember and some of the stories that the language department actually has recorded, because I know that my director here has actually gone out and recorded some of those speakers before they left. And there was only, that I can think of now, there was only four. There was three women and three men, and they've all have passed on since I've worked here. So it just shows you the criticalness of it, of, you know, our language, you know, becoming extinct within the next 20 years. On LTBB Odawa, on our reservation, as of now, we do not have a fluent speaker anymore. The last one, actually, one of our last speakers, actually just passed recently. So, you know, we work constantly and daily on preserving and revitalizing language. And of course, in their memory and in their honor, but it is, you know, it is so urgent, you know, to get not only the language recorded, but we're trying to get the language to be in daily use again as a daily natural conversation.
Tell me a little bit more about the work that you do and what resources you think are most helpful in terms of making communities and their language whole again. I know some tribes, you know, that have a radio station, you know, kind of incorporated into their programming. There are some tribes in the U.S. where schools are able to actually do full-on classes. Where are you focusing your efforts right now, and what would you hope to do in the coming years?
So there's only three language instructors pretty much in the community. And we all can't be placed in a school, right? That's just not a reality. So I was teaching in the high school. So I was in Harbor High School and Petoskey High School. So in Petoskey, I would teach Anishinaabe Mohen 1 and 2 in the mornings. And then I would go over to Harbor Springs, which is about a 20-minute drive, go to that high school and teach Anishinaabe 1 and 2 in the afternoons. So that was very tough, but I was, you know, I was doing it, and there were so many high schools that wanted language as a choice for world language for graduation, and we had so many local high schools that wanted us, you know, that were requesting Anishinaabe Mohen in their high school, and we just couldn't do it because pretty much I was the only teacher doing that at that time. So our efforts right now, what we're really focused on is online and virtual. We're able to reach a wider range of tribal members and students, you know, going virtual and going online. So we've been really concentrating on that. When the pandemic hit, we actually had a community class. It was face-to-face, and there was maybe, I would say, 10 students, some of them families, some of them would bring in their families. And we actually have a fluent speaker that works for our tribe. She's not from here, but she's Anishinaabe Kwe from Shishiguaning Wequemagong Reserve in Ontario. And that reserve in Ontario has the closest dialect to our Odawa dialect. So we've really learned a lot from them. Our past fluent speakers have been hired from there. So that is, you know, that's where we get a lot of our resources and a lot of our support. So she's from there. She also went to a boarding school. I'm not sure which one in Canada, but she also, I believe it was just a day school. But I know when she tells us stories, her grandmother actually took her and her siblings and they hid when the Canadian government came around to collect
First Nations children, Native children. They call them First Nations in Canada. It's the same thing as we call them here, Native children. So when they came around to collect children, she hid. And so her grandmother took all of them and they would go hide in the woods. They actually had a camp. So even though she did go to a day school, she didn't go to the actual boarding school where they took them away from the families. So she was able to go and, you know, learn English, but she kept her language. So did her siblings. And I think they kept their language because their grandmother did that, took them and hid them so they wouldn't be taken away. And she had a community class that was open to the community. You didn't even have to be tribal to take the class. She just wanted to, you know, get our language out and for everyone to become aware, you know, of who we are. And this is how we sound. This is our language. So that was going on. The pandemic hit. So we had to think fast. Okay, what are we going to do to keep this community class going? And so we got on Zoom. We got an account and we started a community class, one for beginners, one for a little more advanced students. And we did that every week.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking today with Natan Kiogama, Anishinaabe Mohin language specialist with the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians, and also with Eric Hemingway, director of archives and records for the tribe. Are there specific actions that you would like to see come out of the Interior Department's investigations?
As far as what's going on in Canada, you know, to our First Nation relatives, I think it's America's turn now to bring this, you know, up in front. So what I would also like to do as part of healing is I would also like to request from our TIPO director, that's Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, and then it's Eric as well, is maybe we need to start doing the underground radar, or the, I don't know how do you say that, the seismic, the machine that found, the technology that found all of those graves at Kamloops. I think we need to do that here at Holy Childhood.
Yeah, just to explain for folks, the Canadian boarding school sites, this is a technology that really made it possible. Obviously, a lot of folks have some sensitivity about whether or not those children who died there should be exhumed, but there are things that can be done to deliver more information about the sites if tribes are able to make it happen. Eric, have you heard about whether Interior is interested in taking it that far with the investigations it's doing in the United States?
No, I just seen the announcement by Deb that this is going to be an investigation and it's going to take years. I mean, there's so many of these schools and the amount of work, it's going to be quite staggering, but tribes have resources that they can lend to this. You know, we have, you know, museums, archives, TIPOs, and it's going to be a joint collaborative, I feel. But as Natan was saying about, you know, identifying who's, in my mind, you have to identify. I'm not saying, you know, exhuming or taking anybody out of the ground, but you have to know if they're there. And this goes not just for Holy Childhood, but all these schools. And they have the technology that can do this, and it's non-invasive. You don't have to dig. So it's there.
This question of what things need to happen next to remedy what happened to language and what happened in boarding schools, it's really complex. For everyone who's got a piece of this, it's a very personal story, as you've both said. What do you both think is important to keep in mind, both in terms of accountability and overall in terms of healing? Natan, do you want to go first? And then Eric, I'm curious about what you have to say about this as well.
Well, that's, to me, I think healing is going to happen with our youth and that generational gap there of trying to connect our elders with our youth. From my experience of when I first heard our native language and when I connected with it and really was drawn to it was when I was a youth. So I think going into the high schools and trying to recruit language students was, you know, kind of one of the first, you know, tactics that we you know, did and used. And that actually worked. You know, we did get some language students out of there. We did get, you know, passing that knowledge on. And when they grew up and they started having their kids, you know, so I guess just kind of planting that seed with our youth. And that's what we're doing, too, is we're developing online classes that are going in the high schools. So now that I'm pulled out of the high schools, we're developing these online classes. So now all the area high schools here in Northern Michigan and just in our county area can have those. So Petoskey and Harbor will be our pilot programs for these classes. Now, these classes are going to instill pride and knowledge and awareness to Native students. And they're also going to teach non-Native students, you know, who we actually are. You know, because all they're hearing is, you know, from media and from their own families and just from, you know, the more dominant society are pretty negative things about Native people still. And so this also, this class also will kind of bridge that gap of making knowledge available and showing, you know, people who we are through the education system. So I think that's where a lot of healing is going to start too, is just understanding in education. And then when I say bridging the gap with our elders, bringing them together in the community class as well, you know, so trying to have an age range of like, okay, so we do the formal schooling with our high schools, and then we have a community class where we have families that are involved and generations that are involved. So I think trying to bring that back in is definitely a start.
Eric, what's on your mind about this?
Oh, quite a bit, actually. I mean, just having the truth about what happened coming out is a really important and first step to take, that Native people had to endure this on a large scale. And it's loss of life, it's loss of language, it's loss of culture, and it's loss in our own backyard. This isn't a faraway place we have to look to in Canada or Carlisle, it's Harbor Springs. And to have people realize that this happened within our own community, and the community being that of Northern Michigan, and that people are still dealing with what happened. And it's not just for that individual, it's also for the families and the community, because a lot of times these traumatic experiences are passed on to other individuals within the family or community. So it's this ripple effect that's gone through our tribe and other tribes, and to let people bring awareness that this happened, and that it was part of a plan, essentially, to make us be a non-Anishinaabe, to take the Anishinaabe out of us. And this is only for Native people. There wasn't these policies to make any other people white. There was only for Natives. So it's part of this larger plan by the federal government to erase our identity. And a lot of times people got erased in the process. This has been such a tidal wave of emotions. I mean, for myself personally and people around me, like, we know this happened, but when you see the numbers, it's staggering, and it just, you know, it's at these other schools.
Yeah.
And so just having that be known, and then also having the fact that we are not going to sit and be defined by this victimization. And I think Natan's points are very clear to that, that we're, you know, resilient, we're bouncing back, we're having language, we're having this stance that we're not going to buckle and we're going to move forward. So that's, I think, a very key message to drive forward, that this isn't going to define us, but it's part of us.
Eric Hemenway is director of archives and records for the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. And Natan Kiyogama is a language specialist for the tribe. Natan, Eric, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Nahau miigwech, baamampi.
Thanks for having me again. Take care.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Bear. Thank you for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.